Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
We have a trade deal. Just kidding. Markets are high in the hog as China will be purchasing agricultural products. The Fed will pump in another $300 billion into repo markets by year end. And our guest today, CPA Adam Spiegel, on last minute tax tips. All this and much more on episode number 640 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz. It is the second week of December 2019. So glad you're with me today, spending some time talking about finance, money, investments, your retirement, all things related to money. And we're coming into the end of the year. And as we know, the markets are continuing to ride higher as the news of this skinny, partial phase one trade deal is supposed to be approved now. We got lots of information last week coming over the headlines that, well, it's a signed deal, it's a done deal, it's going to be done at 2 o'clock today, it's going to be done at 3 o'clock today. And what is really interesting is that if you really track the timing of the announcements, it's pretty amazing that we did see that at 9:32 in the afternoon, at 2:30 in the, 9:32 in the morning, 2:30 in the afternoon, right up until the close. All these are ways in which markets are the most vulnerable, because on the open, we know that people are positioning. We know towards the end of the day, people are positioning or repositioning ahead of any news. And it is very clear that the powers that be are very aware of all these times and have strategically provided us this information at those exact moments throughout the day. But one thing is really interesting here, because if you really break it down and you look at all of the different components of how these are being presented from both the U.S. side and the Chinese side, we're seeing that China and U.S. have completely different understandings of the deal. And because right now we're still in a situation that nothing is in writing, nothing has been signed. It's all commentary about, yeah, we got a deal and this is the commitment. And we get kind of a couple piece of information. And China then goes and says, well, our understanding of the deal is this. And then President Trump announces that we have this big deal. And then China says, well, yeah, but we thought there was going to be a further rollback of tariffs, which is not exactly what President Trump is agreeing to, it seems. So maybe there's going to be something signed eventually, maybe not. I mean, Larry Kudlow came out at the end of the week on Friday, as he does. He's scheduled for Fridays. That's the scheduling process for the trade deal, is bring out Larry Kudlow on Friday. He even said it was going to take a few weeks to get this down on paper and actually signed. A few weeks. We were supposed to have a deal signed and done 2:30 in the afternoon on Thursday. So what happened? And with all that time in between this discussion from both sides, who knows exactly what's going to be? One thing we do know, yes, the December 15th tariffs that were supposed to be added on, not gonna happen. And that's a win for markets and global economies. No question about that, because the specter of increasing tariffs on particular assets that were going to be very sensitive to the consumer area, not being added, that's a good thing. However, let's refocus. Let's look at what we have. And that is, we still have the original tariffs in place. In reality, what did we get here? We got a nothing burger. Nothing's changed. I mean, nothing has really changed in this whole dynamic, except for a slight rollback of some tariffs from 15% to 7% once the deal is signed. And it looks like, from all accounts, that there's no way that this deal is going to be signed at least until January. And there's another month after that where everything has to go through to get these tariffs reduced. And I think the important thing that we really need to focus in on here is that the tariffs that are currently on will remain and be used as a negotiation tactic for the next phase, phase two. So phase one, what do we get? Well, supposedly we got agricultural purchases by China. Supposedly a commitment to buy upwards of $40 to $50 billion of agricultural products over some time period, which they haven't done in any annual, you know, they haven't done that annually for ever. I mean, they're at $20 or $30 billion maybe, so I don't know how they're going to get to $50. There's also a commitment for another few hundred billion dollars of other purchases of other goods from the U.S., but again, this may not be anything different than what we've seen before. Maybe it's just business as usual. So again, nothing's really changed from where we were, let's say, 2 weeks ago. A slight change. But really, this whole phase one deal is just, I think, a way of not putting on these tariffs into the end of the year that would really spook markets. So utilizing the tariffs that are currently in place for the further negotiation of phase two, which they're going to try to tackle things like IP theft and technology transfers and subsidies. That's going to be the game. And what that means is that we're likely going to see continual headlines throughout 2020. We're also going to see the impact of the current tariffs continue to weigh on global sentiment, corporate spending, and economies, and trade. Don't forget about trade. Trade's going to be a big issue also, because we thought that there was going to be a deal done by now. So a lot of the people that were possibly looking at, you know, better opportunities moving forward into 2020, because some of these tariffs will be lifted, are going to probably continue to hit margins and create uncertainty both on trade and corporations. Listen, I don't have any high expectations that any real breakthroughs are going to happen, especially until the election. They don't have any reason to cave at this point, because they know that, to be honest with you, it looks like the only caving that's going on, the only renegotiation, has been on the U.S. side, and particularly into the election. Because depending on the results of the election, that can change everything. And why not wait it out at this point? It's been going on 2 years already, plus. Why not just wait it out a little bit longer? The other thing that we really know is that we're going to see the potential for headlines related to trade dominating 2020 again. A highly probable situation. So keep that in mind. And realize that a lot of this is fluff. There's a lot of politics involved, a lot of gamesmanship, some form of negotiation that I've yet to figure out. Whereas one side says one thing and it's a done deal publicly, and the other side is like, huh? We didn't agree to that. Where is that coming from? And both sides are using the public venues and the media and social media to try to somehow convince everybody else that something's going on when, in fact, nothing has changed. It's kind of crazy. It's a weird time we live in, to say the least. I want to mention before we get to our guest, thank you so much for the kind and really nice comments that you have sent in. A lot of you have taken the opportunity to provide feedback, ask questions, give me a little bit of insights. Happy holiday wishes. I want to tell you that means a lot to me. This, again, is a two-way conversation. It's a union of both what we're providing here, but also you as the listener providing the feedback and giving us insights into, you know, what would make this show the best possible benefit for your financial future. And in order to do so, just go over to The Disciplined Investor, click on the button that says Ask Andrew, and simply write in whatever you want. It could be something really nice. It could be a criticism. It's an open field of opportunity for you now to communicate and to have this back and forth discussion. And by the way, we've been doing this a while now. We have well over 10 million downloads recorded for the Disciplined Investor podcast since we've been tracking it. There was probably a couple of years that we weren't tracking it back in the early days of 2007, 2008, maybe even 2009. So somewhere along the way, somebody likes what we're doing. And I want to thank you very much for keeping this a really popular show, providing feedback as well as all of your comments and giving us your reviews on iTunes and all those other podcasting services that are available. So thank you so much for that. Early happy holiday wishes to you on that. And just really, really happy the way things are going. So happy the camaraderie and relationship we have on this and what we've made it over the years. So thanks so much for that. Well, with that, I thought what we'd do is it's a good time of year to start thinking about taxes because just in a few weeks, all those decisions you make are pretty much engraved in stone. You can't undo them, can't redo them. So what I thought we'd do is bring on someone who has an expertise in the area with some last-minute tax tips and some ideas on how to make sure that you are, in fact, doing what you can to have the greatest opportunity to, well, let's just face it, have the lowest taxes payable and best net result for you in a variety of areas. So let's get right to it. And our guest today is Adam Spiegel, CPA. He's a principal in the tax and accounting department at MBAF and the managing principal of the Fort Lauderdale office here for MBAF, right down the block from me. And he's been working in this industry since 1993. He's been involved in all aspects of accounting services, accounting systems for closely held businesses and individuals ranging in size from startups to over $1 billion with a B. So he focuses on providing a diverse blend of financial analysis and tax accounting and all that. And I thought that what we'd do today is, as we are close to the end of the year, bring in an expert to give us some insights and tips and some things to do, not only for the end of the year, but what to do to really help us with our taxes moving forward. So Adam, you got your work cut out for you. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much for having me. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Well, listen, we're gonna hopefully save some people some money and give them some really good ideas. And I thought what we'd do is start out with talking about, you know, we had this recent tax law change. Well, it's not so recent anymore, but we had this tax law change. We know that a lot of it really benefited corporations for the most part with a major tax cut. But there was also some other things inside of that whole, the tax bill that maybe some people don't know about. But I was thinking, can you kind of go through some of the highlights of the changes and things people need to know?
Sure, I'd love to. Some of the biggest things in the tax law changes have been items like qualified business income deductions under Section 199 capital A, the use of qualified opportunity zones, the bonus depreciation extension, business interest expense deduction limitations, as well as a whole array of some other stuff.
So the big ones that this, well, we I want to talk about qualified, the special zones and opportunity zones, but the qualified business deduction, that's pretty big, right?
It's huge. In simplification terms, or to simplify it, this deduction helps small businesses, S-corps, partnerships that have pass-through type tax ability to lower their tax rate to a potential 29.6% from the maximum individual rate of 37. That helps keep a differential between big business C-corps that have a higher rate and small businesses that can't go out and raise the money like a public company could.
So now the C-Corps still have, now the reduction in the tax for C-Corps is down to 20%, right, on their net income?
But it's 21% a flat rate for the federal government.
Right.
But don't forget, there's usually state income taxes of approximately 5%. And then when the money gets distributed out to the owners as a dividend, there's another 20 to 23.8% tax on top of that. The effective rate ends up being over 40%, 41 to 45% on big business or C corps.
Right.
When the individual owners that own the shares ultimately get to spend the money individually.
So when somebody sets up a subchapter S or maybe some kind of a limited partnership or some other kind of vehicle for a small business that would qualify for the qualified business deduction, can somebody do that also if they don't have a structure of a subchapter S, let's say, or, I mean, they're just an individual, you know, a DBA kind of thing? Can they take advantage of that?
So sole proprietorships are eligible for it.
Right.
Rental properties on your personal income tax return are eligible for it. Has to do with, is this your trade or business? Is this your active activity that you're involved in? But this qualified business income deduction has certain limitations to it. So there's a whole array of specialized service trade or businesses that are ineligible for this.
Yeah.
Such as lawyers, accountants, doctors, entertainers, athletes. There was even the NFL took this issue up with the federal government, and the owners, even though they own a team, they're not eligible for this deduction.
Hmm. So the point, though, is if you are eligible, and you know maybe some people don't know they're eligible, you need to go make sure to check this out, because this is a pretty, if, you know, again, people that are in a business that make, there's a threshold amount that you can make up to also, right?
Yes, there's a threshold, and it's about $150,000 for an individual or $300,000 for a married couple, where if you earn less than that, this deduction, you're eligible no matter what business in. A doctor is eligible for it. Right. If he owns an S corp and he doesn't earn more than $150,000 as an individual or $300,000 as a married person, a married filer. But once you earn between $315,000 and $415,000, those specialized service industries get phased out. Over $415,000, now it becomes very important to plan to be able to maximize the deduction right. that you're eligible for so that you pay the least amount of tax.
Right. So, I mean, the point here is, I mean, year end, if you haven't really thought through this, obviously this is going to come into the planning part, but you need to make sure that your income that you're generating that's coming through and passing through, if you are a business, that you want to make sure it's properly done, because there's no going back after the year closes. That's the point, right?
Correct. Absolutely. one of the caveats to being eligible for this is that wages need to be paid. So if you're a sole proprietorship and you're the only employee, you're not going to pay yourself wages, so you may not be eligible for this.
But if
you had another employee, you're paying some wages. If you're a business, an S corp or an LLC, you're paying wages to your employees. You may pay wages to yourself. You got to make sure you have enough wages to get the maximum deduction that you can.
Right. It doesn't mean you could hire somebody for the last week and hopefully just pay them, you know, $300 and you get this big deduction.
No, basically the maximum deduction can be 20% of the net income that flows through from the tax return
right.
on the K-1s. It can only be that 20% if wages, 50% of wages exceed that 20%.
Yeah, so you got it's not like
let me give you an example very simply.
Okay.
if I made $1 million, 20% is 200,000.
Right.
If I have 400,000 or more, so that 50% of the 400,000 in wages is 200,000, I'm eligible for a $200,000 deduction. I would only pay tax on 800,000. I would be able to subtract that 200,000. Now, there's a whole lot of other caveats, like if you don't earn money net, you can't take the deduction, or you take a limited amount of the deduction. It's very complicated, and it's important to plan now and throughout the year to get the right wages and to get the right mix to maximize the deduction.
Yeah, but this one's not one, this is not one of those last-minute things. This is just something to, like, know about as you go into – next year, because you want to plan your year appropriately.
Well, I don't think it's too late for that. One sole owner entity that may make a decent amount of money, $500,000, $1 million, and they haven't declared their salary yet. We do a lot of work this time of year to calculate the salary so that you can maximize the deduction.
All right, so that's our year-end planning tip, that if you're in a business and you have the opportunity now to make sure that you maximize the salary compared to shareholder distributions that you take, inclusive of yourself and other employees, do it before the end of the year so that you can maximize the amount that may be available through the qualified business income deduction.
So I have projects going on right now where we're increasing people's salaries to maximize the deduction, or we're going back and amending the payroll tax returns to reduce owner salaries to maximize the deduction.
Interesting. But if you just, I don't want to get in the weeds on this, but if you do push the salary high enough, you could be possibly paying more in FICA on that, right? Upwards of 15% of your sole proprietor.
Well, remember, Social Security, 12.4% of the FICA is limited to somewhere around $130,000 of earnings.
Right.
But then you're paying the excess on Medicare, which could be upwards of 3.8%.
Right.
So if I've got a $700,000 salary, but I only needed a $300,000 salary, I could have paid almost 4% on that extra $400,000.
Yeah, it was $16,000. I got it. So let's kind of segue over just very quickly into opportunity zones. Now, we talked about these opportunity zone funds a few months back. I brought somebody on to explain all about what the opportunity was in the opportunity zone funds, whereas there was, first of all, an explanation of what opportunity zones were. And then secondly, some of these new things that have popped up because there are some special tax treatments that go along with investing in this. So, I mean, this is a little more complicated, to be honest with you. It's a little bit more of a longer term planning situation. It's not like just move something from box 32 to 24. But explain a little bit about what people can do with highly appreciated assets to offset some of the taxes utilizing these opportunity zone funds.
So the qualified opportunity zones start with somebody who had a capital gain, and really any type of capital gain.
Right.
So if you had a highly appreciated asset that you sold, doesn't matter what it is. It could be a piece of property. It could be a stock portfolio. It could be a piece of art. It could be a business. As long as you have a capital gain, the first reason you would invest in a qualified opportunity zone is to defer the tax that's related with that gain. You don't have to put the money into an intermediary's account. You have to invest in a qualified opportunity zone. And one of the caveats there is you have to improve that property you acquired by 100% within a 2.5 year period. So there's a bunch of steps to make sure that you continue to qualify as this qualified opportunity zone investment. But the first goal is deferring the tax from this current year until your 2026 tax year. So you're getting about 7 years of a tax deferral of the capital gains tax.
Yeah.
The second benefit for doing it by the end of 2019 is that you have the potential for 15% of that tax to be wiped out or gotten rid of.
Right.
If you've held that investment for 5 years, you have a 10% abatement of the tax. But if you held that investment for 7 years, you have a 15% abatement of that tax. So instead of paying 100% of the tax on your 2019 return, you potentially could pay 85% of that tax on your 2026 tax return.
But the only problem with this, as I see it, is that, you know, now you take an asset that maybe is, let's just say it's a stock. You have a stock with a very low cost basis, major capital gain potential. You move it into, now what are you moving into? You're moving into a real estate investment, essentially, right?
Correct.
So now you have to be
illiquid.
Illiquid. You don't know what the end's going to be. We're at the high point. A lot of these qualified opportunities, or I shouldn't say qualified, but these opportunity zones, once they're labeled an opportunity zone, interestingly enough, the price of the property underlying it and those properties adjacent to it and around it, I mean, they skyrocket. Because they know they're going to come in and make 100% improvement on the property. So,
correct.
You know, now all of a sudden.
And that's the reason for the incentive the government created this, is to get people to invest in underdeveloped areas within your communities.
Right.
Every state in the country has various zones. In the state of Florida, we have 437 different zones. There will not be new zones, and there won't be changes to the zones. They're fixed. You can find it on a map online. And it's not a specific zip code, but it's a square block or whatever the Census Bureau decided was these underprivileged areas over the last 10 years.
I've looked at all this and I think it's really interesting from a developer standpoint, because a lot of benefits on the developer side. Plus the fact is now you got new money that comes in from other sources. Usually you have, you know, money that's going to come in from where? It's going to come from investors. Maybe banks will be underwriting the deal, but now all of a sudden you have a new stream of money from people who want the monies to go into, you know, these plans to offset their capital gains, and there's a whole new flow of money creating. I mean, I look around here in Fort Lauderdale, the building in some of these opportunity zones is out of control.
Correct.
Manners is one of the
zones, and they're looking for hotels, and they're looking for investment in areas that have historically not had the kind of investment that they needed.
Yep.
The best benefit of this, if you can hold on long term, is that whatever you invest in this zone, if you've held it for more than 10 years, the gain on that when you sell it is all tax-free.
Ah, there you go.
So it's really for long-term investors.
Long-term investors who also want maybe to diversify their portfolio into real estate potentially, or to further diversify their portfolio into real estate and avoid or reduce the amount of capital gains that are paid on highly appreciated assets. That's the bottom line there, right?
Correct.
All right.
Correct.
Let's kind of move a little bit along here. Some other things. Tax losses, harvesting of taxable gains within a portfolio. What should people be looking for this time of year? I mean, what can people do?
The market has done pretty well this year, so most people may have gains in their portfolio. One of the tips that we usually advise is to look at your portfolio, and if you have positions that may have losses, to sell them now and take those losses and offset the gains. Both short-term and long-term capital gains and losses offset against each other first on your tax return. And then if there's an excess In gains, it's taxed at whatever, short-term or long-term. Short-term gains are taxed at ordinary income tax rates. Long-term could be at zero rate, depending on your income, or maximum 23.8% rate.
So this is the time of year, again, because you don't get a redo after the 31st of December. And now, you know, it's also interesting. You don't have to pay commissions, for the most part, on stock trades anymore. I know we just went through... we always do this every year, but this year in particular, we went through a lot of portfolios and we've inherited some stocks for clients over the years. And let's say they're really not worth much. But back in the day, if a stock was worth, let's say somebody has 500 shares, it's only worth $23. I'm like, all right, just leave it in the portfolio right now. We'll deal with it eventually. You know, we'll see what happens with this. It's a loss and maybe we'll just be a complete, you know, loss one day, just rewritten off. But these days... You know, because if we had to trade, let's say 500 shares or something, it would cost us maybe $40. Now that commissions are free, we just wiped them right off the book. Took them out,
right.
Took the loss. So people that are thinking about those small positions that you have, those losers that are frankly never going to come back. You know what I'm talking about, gang. These are the stocks that you bought on a whim. You thought it was a great idea. It dropped off to nothing. Even if it comes back by 500%, you're still 95% underwater probably. You know what I'm talking about. Good time of the year.
But you're getting 20 to 25, maybe even 37% of that loss in a tax savings.
Right. Now, talk about for a second with that. I think anytime we talk about selling to offset and losses and gains, we got to talk about wash sales. I think that's kind of important. Okay. Can you just kind of touch on that?
So wash sales mean that if I took a loss in a position, I cannot buy it back within 30 days. Otherwise, that loss doesn't count at this time. Okay, so you want to be careful to make sure that you don't, in any portfolio, and you have to look at if you have stocks with multiple brokers or in multiple different positions, that you're not buying that particular security back within 30 days. You got to wait 31 days.
Now, the question I've always heard people ask is, okay, so I sell an equity mutual fund. And I buy a different equity mutual fund. That's not a wash sale if it's not the exact same symbol, right?
That's correct.
So it has to be the exact one. So you could do theoretically, I guess, is if you had a loss in an ETF that the symbol is ABC and the similar ETF is trading out there, you could buy back XYZ almost immediately and take the loss.
That's the beauty of the funds.
Yep.
Your fund may be invested in 25 different companies that another fund may be invested in 25 of the same companies. But because you sold this fund and bought that fund, they're apples and oranges.
Right.
So you don't have to dig into the underlying holdings of each fund to determine if you have a wash sale or not.
So let's talk also about some of the use it or lose it rules. I think this is important because a lot of companies now have these flexible spending accounts, these cafeteria, Section 125, and then some of the other ones that are out there as well. And these are accounts where people either individually or the company sets aside for you a certain amount of money that can be used for qualifying healthcare. And some of these plans have what's called a use it or lose it rule, which means by the end of the year, if you don't use it, it's gone, right?
Correct. Well, most of them have a deferral period, so it may be March 15th or March 31st until you can use it. But yes, at some point, if you don't use it, you lose it.
So if you have the opportunity to get your glasses fixed or go for a checkup and pay for the deductible, et cetera, that's a good thing to do there. Income deferral.
You did this. You contributed money out of your payroll to save on Social Security, Medicare, and income taxes.
Right.
If you're not going to use them, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So go ahead and make your doctor's appointment. Go ahead and get the glasses you want. Go ahead and order the contacts ahead
right.
of time.
Right.
Or go see the dentist or whatever checkup you need to make sure you use it and don't lose it.
Yeah. When it comes to charities, so this also can be utilized for some deductions. I mean, people, there's different types of charitable contributions. For example, you can give outright to a charity as long as it's a qualified charity. Get a nice deduction for that. But are there any limitations people need to know about now with the new tax law?
So charities are an interesting case. Charities fall under itemized deductions. And so, first of all, you have to qualify for the itemized deduction, which needs to exceed your standard deduction before it even kicks in. If you're a single person, the standard deduction is somewhere around $13,000-$14,000. A married person, the standard deduction is double that. Mm-hmm. So unless you have enough itemized deductions that exceed your standard deduction, it's not going to help. So some of the planning ideas is when and the timing of when you pay your itemized deductions. Things that fall into itemized deductions are real estate taxes, home mortgage interest, and charities, as well as medical expenses. Charities, maybe you want to double up in 1 year so that you exceed the standard deduction by a large amount and save some taxes. Are there limitations on what you can give? Different types of property have different rules behind the charitable deductions. If you gave art or you gave non-cash items, there could be restrictions or rules around the value you can give or whether or not that charitable organization needs to sign a document that's attached to your return or whether or not there's an appraisal needed. One of the best things for people to give is highly appreciated stock.
Right.
There's two different ways that we suggest people to give that's great for them. Highly appreciated stock can be given directly to a charity, and you get the deduction for the fair market value of that stock. So let's take an example.
Hold on a second. Can I say something? Let me just – one other point there. You get the deduction for the full market value of the stock, and you don't pay tax on the capital gain growth.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. I'm sorry I left that out. Yeah, that's the thing right there.
That's an important one.
So if you've paid $1,000 for 1,000 shares of stock and now it's worth $100,000 and you're going to give it to a charity, you get the deduction for the $100,000, but you don't have to pay the tax on the $99,000 capital gain.
Beautiful. Beautiful. So
okay. The other trick would be for people that have retirement account distributions. They're required to take money out of their retirement account. If they write the checks directly to the charitable organization, it qualifies for the RMD, but it doesn't necessarily need to go into the itemized deduction page. So it comes off of the taxable amount of the RMD. So you fulfilled your requirement to take money out of the retirement account, it just reduces your taxable income.
So let me just restate. Let me restate this. So we're clear about this. You're above the age of. It's not just RMD though. It's any retirement distribution, right? So if you're above the age of 59 and a half,
correct,
and you take a distribution from your IRA, and that distribution is paid directly to the charity, that passes right by your income?
It gets reduced from your income calculation. If you think of your adjusted gross income on your tax return, it's a reduction to arrive at your adjusted gross income. Your itemized deductions, where charitable contributions usually flow in, is below the adjusted gross income line to reduce your adjusted gross income to arrive at your taxable income.
You reduce it above.
So think about elderly people. They're worried about what their adjusted gross income is because it affects your cost of Medicare or Part A, Part B, Part D. And so if they can fulfill their desire to give to a charity and reduce their adjusted gross income by having it come out of their IRA and go directly to the charity, they fulfilled their requirement for their IRA, required minimum distribution, or whatever they wanted to come out of there, and reduce their adjusted gross income and maintained a lower cost of Medicare or and the drug costs and stuff like that, the supplemental costs.
So here's the tip for the end of the year. First of all, look into charitable donations to make sure that you have those that you want to give that can help you reduce down your income if, in fact, you itemize. Secondly, there are things like highly appreciated stocks that are a really good way to gift to offset the problems of paying capital gains tax on that highly appreciated asset and at the same time get a deduction at the fair market value. And the third thing is to look at IRA distributions if you're over the age of 59 and a half, or if you have to take required distributions over the age of 70 and a half, pay that to a charity, reduce the AGI. Let me just throw out one more thing. It's a great time of year also, just a general time of the year to kind of start going through your closet and your junk drawers. Everybody's got a junk drawer somewhere, you know, and you find all these different things that you're like, oh, I want to keep it. If you're a mini hoarder, or if you're even just someone who just, you know, doesn't throw out everything, it's a great time of year to take that and go put it at whether it's a Salvation Army or whether it's whatever particular charity that will take that kind of goods and get a receipt for that and then put that into your file, give it to your accountant when he's doing your taxes, and then take that as a tax deduction. Just a side.
Yeah, those deductions, those non-cash deductions are limited to what the fair market value of those goods are. So usually you use a thrift shop value. There are tables online that can help you decide what a shirt is worth, or a pair of pants, or a jacket, or a typewriter, or a computer, or a radio, all kinds of these old things we don't use anymore.
Right, right. Typewriter. Ha! How about an 8-track cassette, reel to reel, you know, a Betamax. Okay, so.
A VCR.
Yeah, exactly. Crazy stuff like this. So we got the charity stuff. So I want to kind of segue just for a second into a couple different things here. So first of all, a lot of people think, oh, you know, I'm going to extend. I'm not going to file on time. Is there any kind of red flag or any kind of issue with extension? Is there any benefit? You still have to pay on time.
I don't believe there's any benefit or detriment whether you file on time or you extend. The real key is to make sure you have a good estimate of what your tax liability is and make sure it's completely paid in by April 15th. This time of year, you should really be planning and estimating what your tax is to make sure you're penalty proof for the current year's taxes. The rules are not that complicated, but you should be penalty proof by paying either 110% of your prior year's tax or 90% of the current year's tax, whichever is the lesser amount.
But that's only for people that aren't under 100% wages, right? Because 100% wages doesn't have to worry about this. In other words, if you're having payroll...
Everyone needs to worry about it, because if they don't withhold properly on your wages, then you may not be penalty proof.
So with the change in withholding allowances, or the withholding amount that was kind of like tripped people up last year, remember that? Where the taxes went down. Did that cause any of that problem?
It did. The intent behind that was to put money into taxpayers' pockets sooner than at the end of the year after they filed their return. When you have a situation that, let's say, a husband and a wife both earn money and they're not withholding at a rate that tells their employer, my wife or my spouse is earning additional dollars and I may need to withhold at a higher rate because one person's earnings just adds to the other person's earnings.
Right, the tax is higher.
You could be in a situation where a lot of people found themselves owing more money than they thought they would.
Yeah, which is what happened last year.
employers were empowered to reduce people's withholding based on the new tax rates. What people should be doing, which may be too late for 2019, but it's a good time for 2020, is revisiting the W-4 form, which is where the employee instructs the employer how much to withhold, how many allowances they have, how many dependents they have, what their marital status may be, to make sure the withholding is accurate as best as possible for the following year.
So when it comes to the whole idea of I touched the idea of red flags. You know, I mean, you know, is it extension a red flag? What are the red flags that people kind of the most common red flags that people need to be aware of?
So the worst thing to do is to not file time.
Not file enough. Okay. File timely. Not file at all.
Not file at all, or not file by the extended due date if you did an extension, or not file by the original due date if you didn't do an extension. The biggest red flag is not making some sort of filing or declaration with the IRS, because 9 times out of 10, your employer or your investments you've had have sent information to the IRS showing that you earned money. And so the absence of filing will create correspondence and create a headache with the service center that no one needs. For example, if there was a portfolio that sold $1 million worth of stock, may not have made a dollar, and you didn't file and declare I lost $100,000 or I netted zero on those stock sales, I could get a notice from the government saying I owe tax on $1 million.
You know, I've seen that. I've seen that happen, actually. You've probably seen this too, right?
I've seen it many times, and it's all because you didn't file. The second worst thing I see a lot is that people file, but they forgot, oh, I had money in this account, and I earned some interest on it. Or I had a brokerage account, and I got a 1099. I didn't include it in my filing. I got a K-1 from an investment. I haven't talked to those people in years, and they never sent me the K-1, right. But I didn't include it in my tax return.
And I didn't ask, right, yeah.
Correct. So it's important to make sure you know what's being reported to the government, and you're including that in your tax return.
I mean, if I get a bank account that has, you know, some money in it, but they pay me 3 cents of interest, is that something I have to report?
No.
I mean, you know, under 10 cents? No, right?
No, I don't think the banks issue a 1099 to you unless it's $10 or more.
Right.
It's not a headache if you missed $100 here when you earned $100,000, but it will trigger a notice at some point in the future. Yeah. So for people like myself that time is money, it could be a headache.
Yeah.
If you're paying out money to respond to the IRS, the last thing you want to be is in this correspondence back and forth with the IRS.
Yeah, no fun. And raise their flag to your
existence.
The
earlier you file, the better off you are. So when you talk about filing on time or extending, one of the things that people don't realize is they're also extending the statute of limitations for the government to examine that return.
By the amount of the extension?
By the amount of the time they waited to file. Right. So if I filed an extension April 15th and I didn't file my return until September 1st, the government has 3 years from September 1st, the date of my filing, to examine that return. If I had filed by April 15th or earlier, the government only had until 3 years from April 15th to examine that return.
And the government, the statute of limitation on, or I don't know if it's statute of limitation, but the time period for which they could look back. I mean, what is the recommended holding period for tax returns? Now that it's digital, it's a different story. But I'm saying, generally speaking, you need 5 years of back taxes, right? something like that?
So the statute of limitations is typically 3 years unless you committed fraud, or you believe you committed fraud, or you believe you didn't report income you should have reported on the return. Mm-hmm. Then the statute, if those situations hang out there, it's 6 years. If they think you blatantly underreported or didn't report your income, there's no statute of limitations because they
that's
can
fraud.
Go
that's
back
fraud.
Indefinitely
that's
because of fraud.
Right.
So if you're going to take a risk that's a smaller percentage of your total income,
right.
than all of it,
yeah.
or more than 25% of your income. Mm-hmm. You want it to be a small amount.
I hear
now,
you. Yeah, that makes
so,
sense.
So the rule of thumb is you're going to keep your information. Imagine for 2019, I'm going to file in 2020. They have 3 years from that date to challenge my deductions and my income and that return. So I want to keep all the documentation that supports my deductions and supports my income that was reported on that return or not reported on that return, so I have it in case they examine me. Anything that's not, you're not taking a tax deduction, you don't need to save those records. A lot of people save them electronically nowadays, mm-hmm. in a piece of software, a scanning software right into the computer.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. Whether you have it in an accounting system or you have it in your hard drive, it doesn't really matter as long as you can get at it.
You can access it. And this is really the tip I want to kind of finish off with in terms of the next year. So one of the things you want to do is keep good records as best as possible. We all know it's a drag, saving every receipt that you have for a lunch that's maybe a business lunch. Or, I mean, you know, hopefully some of the credit card receipts will qualify, but then you have to go backwards and figure out, okay, who is it with? So doing it at the time is probably the easiest way to do it, to figure out, you know, is this a receipt that is utilized?
Contemporaneous right. documentation, which means doing it at the time, is what the service center requires.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like when you go back and recreate the accounting records. They want to see the contemporaneous logs of stuff, even though it may be 2-3 years later when they're examining you.
It's not easy. Let's be honest. I mean, it is tedious, some of this to do. But the fact is, kind of a little bit of effort on the front end probably is going to save you a lot of heartache and headache and cost to the accounting firm for the work that they're going to have to do to keep you, you know, making sure that you're not going to pay severe penalties. Because, I mean, you know, assuming it's not fraud, you're not going to get locked up. It's going to be time of your life, and it's going to be penalties and money that you're going to have to disgorge or pay back or, you know, deal with. And who wants to do any of that?
Nobody.
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 Nobody. Listen, we're going to end it here because we're running out of time, but I want to mention that Adam's information on how to get in touch with him, if you have any questions, you want to find out more about what he does and how he can help you, will be on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So at the episode, what are you, episode 640, sorry, a little backwards there, 640 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So make sure you do that. Great guy, great accounting, great firm, team behind him. And I highly recommend his work. So I appreciate you coming on board today. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to share some of these thoughts with you.
All right, buddy. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Good stuff. I mean, listen, probably a few more things that we didn't cover because this is so many possibilities. It's a great time to reach out to those that you're working with in the area of finance, whether it's your investment advisor, whether it's your CPA, and just ask the question. Simply say, hey, what can I do for the end of the year that could really benefit me from a tax standpoint? Send them an email. They may come back and say, well, you know what? We've done it all. You're in great shape, but it can't hurt. Getting that information could provide you maybe some tax relief into next year. Why not do it if you can? We're going to wrap it up right there. I want to thank you again for joining us, and we're going to see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions. nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.